Jungle Jam Podcast with Daniel Cleland and some other cool people who have really cool things to say.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another edition of the Jungle Jam Podcast with Dan Cleland, myself. I am sitting in Toronto with a good friend of mine, a contributor to our Pulse Tours website, a man who has embarked upon a journey of world-changing awesomeness. Since his first experience with ayahuasca a few years back. This is Guy Crittenden.
Hey, Dad.
So, Guy is a writer by trade. He has worked in the publishing industry, and now having experienced ayahuasca a few years back, Guy has come back to the modern developed or quote unquote developed world and embarked upon his shamanic journey. Guy, would you like to talk a little bit about how your transition came about and going forward?
Yeah, sure. I'll just give a quick sketch of my background so people have a sense of who I am. I'm originally from Toronto, and back in the late 80s, 1989, I joined with a couple of other guys and we started a small publishing company, and for the following 10 years we produced two magazines. One was a magazine about pollution control, and the other one was on waste management and recycling. So these were industry business publications focused on environmental protection. In 2000, we sold the business to a conglomerate. My other partners went off and did other things after a while. I stayed with the new owner for the next 15 years. So up until the end of 2014, I had almost to the day a 25-year career as an environmental journalist. I won more Kenneth R. Wilson awards for excellence in business journalism than anyone else, if I can toot my own horn here. I won 14 of them, ranging from best feature to best editorial. One year I won the gold and the silver prize for best editorial. So nobody outside the Canadian business press would know about the Kenneth R. Wilson Awards, but they were kind of like our Oscars for that little fish pond. Anyway, it would have been around 2011, I was starting to get really restless, and I knew that my divorce would be paid for and I'd be in a financial position to do other things with my life. And I started ruminating and I started going through, well, I wouldn't call it a dark night of the soul, but I was getting very tired of where my career was at. And I had friends who had been to Peru and Ecuador and they'd drank ayahuasca. And they'd had other experiences like that. And it got me thinking. And so what I decided was, and Dan, your company, Pulse Tours, was a catalyst for all this, I decided that this was something I wanted to do. What I was looking for was a way to kind of celebrate my 25 years in the environmental business just before I left it. And the best way for me to do that was to go to the Mecca of the environment, which is, of course, the Amazon, and just get out of Canada and do something just completely offbeat that that was way outside my comfort level, very different from anything. Even though I've done a lot of travel, I'd never done trekking in the jungle. But I didn't know who to take the trip with. And then one day I was on the internet and I saw a little promotional video that Pulse Tours had done that showed the combination of going into the jungle for 5 or 6 days and seeing animals and things, and also going to a spiritual retreat center and drinking ayahuasca with the curanderos or shamans. And I looked at that and I thought, wow, that is exactly what I'm looking for. And then I remember trying to contact you and you were off in the jungle, and it took me a while to get in touch and tee up the trip. But as you recall, I joined a group, yourself and Tatiana and a group of guys from Canada at the end of 2013. It's hard to believe that that's only 3 years ago, because we're coming up on the 3-year anniversary of that, and it feels like a decade ago. I've experienced so much transformation and change. So I went on the trip and really enjoyed seeing Iquitos and going to the Belém market and going on the treks. Man, we were doing like 3 treks a day on that trip. That was hardcore.
Yeah, that was back when we had the jungle trip separated from the ayahuasca. So it was like all jungle all day for about 3 days, and then all shamanism all day for the rest of the trip.
Yeah. I remember we would even do the night treks. And there was one time I had the opportunity to bail and just hang out, because they were physically demanding. But we had such a good group, and I felt a sense of camaraderie. And it was almost like being a member of an army platoon. You don't want to let the guys down. So I went on every one of those. And we really bonded as a group. I've ended up remaining friends with almost all the people who are on that trip. Some of them are actually close friends, and we hang out. I just had dinner with Carl the other night, and I'm still in touch with Michael Sanders, who wrote a book about the trip, Ayahuasca and Executives Enlightenment, which I helped edit. And so, boy, we got a lot out of one trip. And everybody on that trip, I think, had their life quite transformed. My roommate, John, had a vision on the trip, I think from ayahuasca, that he should sell all his possessions. He was living in Florida then, and he should move to Hawaii and become a jewelry maker or something like that. And he actually did it. Like, he came back, sold all his stuff, got rid of all his fish tanks, and then moved to Hawaii. So be warned, if you go on these kinds of trips, you really might have a very different life after than the one you had before.
So what has materialized for you? You came back after the trip, you came back to Toronto,
let me just say one thing about how I responded to the shamanic plant medicine. Everyone on that trip, we did three ceremonies spaced apart, and it was interesting. Everyone popped in a different way, as you recall. And I don't know, I guess I was born for this stuff, because I popped really big. And I remember Michael Sanders was the other guy. It's not that it's a competition. Everyone's experience was profoundly meaningful for them. And sometimes, as you know, this stuff works through your body and resets you on a physical level, and you're not having visions, but you are getting something from it. But I was one of those people, and I feel very blessed, actually, that I had really incredible psychedelic visions, spirit quest stuff, right from the first 10 minutes of the first ceremony. It was just like insane. And that's how it's always been for me. I've drank ayahuasca about a dozen times now, and I've done Santo Daime a couple of times, and I've been to Huachuma ceremonies, which is the San Pedro cactus. And I don't know, I really resonate with this stuff. So In fact, I remember thinking after the first ceremony, I will spend the rest of my life just trying to figure out what happened in the first 10 minutes after that medicine came on, because a whole realm, another dimension of reality opened up to me that I didn't know about before. It's what Terence McKenna and his brother called the invisible landscape. And that doesn't happen for everybody. And it took me a while to realize. I came back to Canada, and of course I'm a communicator, and I started writing about my experiences. Then I started going to gatherings and talking with people, sometimes very casually. And I kind of thought, if I could do it all over again, I would have a little bit more humility, in the sense of realizing that my experience was very unique to me. And there's some people who have similar experiences, but not everyone gets the same thing out of it that I did, which is sort of obvious. But so I get back to Canada, and I think, okay, that was really life transforming, and it gave the first thing effect it had is it gave me the courage to quit my job. I decided I would leave at the end of the year. Which I did. I gave my notice in the fall of 2014 and left a 25-year career. And it's kind of funny, or not funny, what happened, because my coworkers, sometimes they'd say it, sometimes you could just tell, they were like, oh, wow, you're leaving all that job security, and you're leaving the comfort. Like, they were working for this big company, as was I. Well, within about 2 weeks of my leaving, it was the middle of January of 2015, that company imploded. It turned out that the parent company was doing funny things with its accounting and owed the federal government something like $23 million. And so they took our trade magazine division and broke it apart, and suddenly all the magazines were sold off, and all my coworkers were out on the street without a job. Some of the editors or publishers of the individual magazines bought their publication. But wow, it's like, and people said to me, did you like know that something was going to happen? Did you know about this? And I said, no, I had no idea, but the timing was really good. And that was really, when I think back on it, I look at reality very differently these days. There was a bit of a shamanic dimension to that. It was almost like, this happens with a lot of psychedelic experience, not just people who delve into shamanism. People start experiencing a lot of synchronicities. And that was the first really big synchronicity, that I made the decision to get out, and it turned out that that was incredibly good timing. Now, you could say that would have happened anyway, and maybe it would have, but that was the first major effect it had. The other thing that happened was really, really weird, that I hadn't foreseen. And that was, I thought, okay, I went to Peru, I drank the medicine 3 times, I didn't know if I'd ever do it again. I came back, I was thinking about it, but I returned to my life and my responsibilities in the 3D world. But something really strange started happening. I started having what I initially called psychedelic experiences, but I would now call them shamanic journeys, without any plant medicine. And it would occur usually, this is about 3 months after the trip, and I'd start having these lucid dreams, and then I'd wake up and I'd be awake, and I'd be having ayahuasca-type visions at about 3 or 4 in the morning, 5 a.m. in the dark. And it took me a long time to figure out what was going on, because I thought, oh my God, have I damaged my brain? Are these like acid flashbacks that I'm having? And I was really concerned. But I went online and I joined some shamanic discussion groups on Facebook and elsewhere. And I made some friends who just knew a lot more about this than I did. And they said, no, you're... that medicine has opened up a portal for you. It's like the third eye has been opened up. Before that trip, I didn't even know anything about third eyes and the pineal gland and this stuff. And I'm given to understand the reason that that it often happens at that time in the morning is that's the time of rapid eye movement or REM sleep, when your naturally occurring endogenous DMT levels, that's the dimethyltryptamine, which makes you dream, is naturally at an elevated level. So it's like the ayahuasca, which for which the active chemical is DMT, opened up this portal and then it stayed open. And At first I was very resistant to it, and I didn't want to have these experiences, although I have to admit they were pretty cool. And then over time I decided I really have no choice but to go forward and to go deeper and to work with these medicines more and to pursue what I will very loosely call a shamanic path, because I certainly don't consider myself to be a shaman in any traditional sense. But I've learned there's very different ways of following a shamanic path, where it doesn't have to say I am a Guy Crittenden shaman on my business card. So that was very unexpected. So I then started a journal. So I had a friend, Carol, who is a very interesting woman. She's a death doula. So she is an intuitive or a medium, and she helps people transition. Just like you have a midwife for someone being born into this world, she works with people who are transitioning from this world to the next one. And she gave me a bit of guidance and some really good advice, and one of them was to keep a journal and to start really following the changes I was going through. I haven't made a journal entry recently, but I've been pretty good about it. And man, I mean, it's if I were to print it off my computer, it would be hundreds of pages now, recording the different phenomenon that I've experienced, which I'm going to pause for a breath, and if you want to ask me a question, but I'm happy to sort of elaborate a bit on that.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, again, this is my journey, this is my experience, this probably only happens to a small minority of people. You know, a lot of people will go to South America or wherever, and they'll drink ayahuasca, and they'll have a life-changing experience. They'll have some insights into their childhood traumas, their PTSD, which I think we all have. And then that'll be it. Like, they'll go home, they'll go back to their life, and that's great. I started having these visionary experiences. And I broke them down to a number of phenomena. I won't list them all, but just to give you a feeling for it. One was that I could sit in bed in total darkness, and sometimes I would see a landscape. And I don't mean one of those out-of-focus, dreamy landscapes you would see in a dream. I mean my entire visual plane was filled in a brightly lit landscape that I could look at, and it would only last a few seconds, maybe 5 or 6 or 10 seconds, although it felt longer. And I could see, I remember one, I was looking across a river and there was houses and farms on the other side, and there were trees and animals walking around. And I could focus on every leaf, on every tree, and every detail of that landscape, just as if I was actually in front of a landscape. And it blew my mind the first time I saw it, that kind of thing. And admittedly, those are fairly rare. But I've had those experiences, and I realize, okay, this is not a dream. I'm fully awake. I'm sitting up in bed. I can pinch myself. And I am looking at a landscape that is somewhere, but it's like looking into a crystal ball. I'm seeing a landscape somewhere that's real, but I'm seeing it in my bedroom in the dark. And that raises some interesting ontological questions, like, is it really a landscape? Is it in Canada? Is it in some other part of the world? Is it in some other time and place? Maybe I'm looking at a landscape that's from hundreds of years ago. So I had a number of those, and I consider those now to be connections with a kind of universal consciousness that allows me and allows anyone who has this kind of openness to periodically see. And I suspect that really experienced, highly trained shamans can control those experiences, and they can fly their consciousness into an actual landscape somewhere and see stuff that then gives them useful information to bring back to their tribe or their people, which apparently shamans and curanderos are known to be able to locate where the good hunting grounds are, where the animals are. They find lost items, they find missing people, like that story we heard on our trip from Victor about his mother being lost and found by a shaman when she went missing in the jungle. So that was one phenomenon. The other one that really, well, a lot of it is kind of psychedelic sacred geometry and stuff that doesn't have a particular landscape or anything to it. There's a lot of that. But the freakiest one was I started being visited by a spirit animal. Now, this is a phenomenon that's familiar to shamans, but I was totally unprepared for this. Like, what the hell is a spirit animal, or sometimes they're called power animals? And I've been told you shouldn't talk about it because it can take away the power of it, but I am a communicator, and the medicine has specifically told me to talk about my experiences, so I do. A lot of shamans and students of shamanism have these experiences, but they don't talk about them. What would happen was I would be sitting at my computer, or I'd be driving, and I'd see this little light in the distance. It would start just as a kind of flicker or a little watery place near the center of my vision that I couldn't really see what it was, but suddenly I would have difficulty reading the text on my computer screen, or I'd think, geez, I need to pull over. It's not good for me to drive. And it would get bigger and bigger and bigger, and this thing would fly toward me very slowly, and it's about a 20 or 30 minute experience. And what it was and is, because I had one just yesterday, it was a snake. It was a kind of anaconda type of snake. It was sort of in a C shape, if you can imagine, so a semicircle. And it was made up of brilliant white light with very black markings on it. And this thing would get closer and closer till it filled my entire visual plane and I couldn't see anything else. Or maybe I could see a little bit, like it was superimposed on the landscape behind. But I definitely couldn't drive, and I definitely had to shut my computer. And then it would kind of go over my head, and I would, for the longest time, I'd think when it visited me, well, where's it going? I kept thinking it was flying past my head. I'm a bit of a slow learner. And I eventually realized it was going in the top of my head, like in the crown chakra. And I've spoken to various people from a yoga background who say it's kundalini energy. I've spoken to people who are shamans who say it's a spirit animal. I mean, these things, as with all shamanic experience, there's no one clear way to interpret them. But you meet, just like you meet ayahuasca halfway, you sit up and you bring your attention to the experience, and then the ayahuasca brings something from the other side. It's very much like that with a spirit animal. If I decide that it's a dark energy and I'm frightened of it, that's what it'll be. But if I decide, no, this is an ally, and this is the spirit of Mother Ayahuasca, or even Gaia, calling me to go deeper into my journey and reminding me, hey, buddy, you've been spending a lot of time distracted. You need to pay attention to the work. Then it'll be that, which is how I've treated it. So every time I have one of these, you know, it's just a reminder that I need to go back to working with one or another medicine and continuing on my path. So as you can see right in front of you now, in the past year, I've put a really large anaconda spirit snake tattoo on my arm because I felt compelled to do that to honor this animal. I needed to put it on my body.
So you guys can't see, of course, but what I'm looking at right now, it's almost like Guy has a 4 foot long, or maybe even 6 foot long, anaconda wrapping around his arm in the form of ink from shoulder to fingertip. And this officially makes us anaconda brothers, because I've got a tattoo of two anacondas on my forearm as well.
Yeah.
Snakes are, for some reason, very common in ayahuasca visions.
Yeah, I've done a bit of research on it. I think of it as Satchamama, and in the Kero culture, which is the culture of the northern, the highlands in the Andes, where the Inca traditions were kept in more intact than in the lowlands where the Spanish killed all the priests, the Kero people, which is Q'ERO, they have these two primary gods. They have a number of them. One is Pachamama, which would be similar to our Earth Mother, and then Satchamama is the anaconda or snake that is in the sky. So the sky god is on top of the earth god. So you have Satchamama and Pachamama.
And Yakumama, which is the river.
Right, exactly. And interestingly, the anaconda is a river snake, so it moves between all those worlds. And you know, I won't go on about it, but suffice it to say, the serpent shows up in every major culture in the world. In China, it's the dragon. In South America, it was the plumed serpent, or Quetzalcoatl. In Celtic shamanism, the snake, like you see the two, the medical pharmaceutical symbol of the double helix intertwined snake, that's an ancient shamanic symbol of healing and communication. So it's in the Aborigine culture in Australia, you have the rainbow serpent. So this snake that often shows up in ayahuasca ceremonies is a symbol of ayahuasca, but it seems to be a more universal way that this cosmic intelligence manifests itself to communicate with us. And so, again, having done that research, I'm a little self-conscious talking about this because I'm aware that this could sound very egoic, like, ooh, my visions are better than other people's, ooh, I'm a really cool guy who's got this snake tattoo and I'm better than ever, like, you know, bragging rights kind of thing. And I just have to say, I have had my ass handed to me by that medicine so many times. I have had my ass kicked. My ego has been so shredded that although I'm always watchful for spiritual ego, I think I can honestly just, I can tell you about this, and you just have to take my word for it that I don't feel that way about it. I feel very humble and, if anything, afraid of this thing, because I know I might even get my ass kicked the next time I do ayahuasca for talking in this interview and being braggy. So that phenomenon started happening, and so I made a lot of changes in my life to orient myself around this. But now you might say, what has this all communicated to me? Like, because I wondered this, does this mean that I need to become a curandero and go and apprentice with some guy like Wheeler down in South America and become an apprentice shaman and serve people ayahuasca or become a healer and all this jazz? And I really asked the medicine that, and the medicine said, no, you are not a healer in that sense. Your gift is your writing. Your writing is your medicine bundle. And I want you to write, have these experiences and these insights that I will give you, and you write them, and you get that information out to the world, because the world needs that information. And I can influence the minds of thousands of people that way. there's plenty of people who can serve ayahuasca and do those kinds of healings. What I am apparently needed for is to communicate this shamanic information that our colonial culture has suppressed for 400 years. And we've gone around, our dominator culture and our capitalist culture has gone around the world and it's genocided indigenous people. And so I have a strong sense of missionization to communicate about this, hence my writings on Pulse Tours and other websites. And I'm slowly starting my own book. I'm embarrassed to even mention it because I'm so far behind schedule on it. But eventually there will be a book that I'll write about my experiences. Yeah.
Well, that's that kind of spurs me to touch on a point that I wanted to make. Ayahuasca often opens people up to new streams of thought and new levels of commitment to doing what's right for the world. You and I agree on a lot of points regarding how culture is interacting with the environment. This is modern day culture, and we're both very passionate about environmental causes and doing what we can as communicators, you know, as leaders, to, you know, influence people in a way that is more sustainable, you know, for the future or regenerative for the environment. Still tons of work to go. You know, we're like, I'm just very beginning stages here as far as what I think I would like to do with my life. So you're going out, you're doing, you're writing, I've been reading your Facebook posts, and you don't hold back any punches, right? You don't hold any punches. You are really, I guess, in a style similar to a Chris Hedges or a Noam Chomsky, two people who you reference quite a bit. You're really going out there and expressing your disliking for how some things are unfolding and potentially offering up solutions.
Right.
How did the medicine inspire or energize or motivate you to get out and really start getting, you know, sharpening your axe blade, mm-hmm. your literary axe blade and start chipping away?
Well, I'm so glad you asked that because that was kind of the next step in all of this. I would go to, okay, so I was having these visits from this spirit animal and I was having these psychedelic experiences without medicine. And I've worked with other medicines like mushrooms and wachuma and so on. I've even been working with edible cannabis recently and finding it now takes me to the same place. Like that's just as a footnote. When you work with these medicines, for some people, you will find that almost any psychotropic plant will take you to the spirit realm because you've opened it up. but you know they don't call them teacher plants for nothing. I have found that I can go to these plants and write down questions before a ceremony, and I can specifically ask the plant for those kind of answers to, you know, well, what do you want me to do with this knowledge? What do you want me to do in the world? Now, whether it's the plant itself or that I'm in touch with a cosmic consciousness, as I think of it, because I feel I've interacted with something that some people would call God. Some people would, Terence McKenna would have called it the transcendental object at the end of time. It doesn't really matter what you call it. But I have found myself interacting with an intelligence that seems to know everything. And maybe it's all in my head, and maybe it's outside my head. I don't know, and I don't know that it matters. But what I found with the medicine was it just specifically said to me, look, there are already people like Chris Hedges and Glenn Greenwald and Julian Assange out there doing excellent work as researchers and writers about what's wrong in our 3D world and the need to make changes to our political system, which I think we all understand after the recent US presidential primaries, which if that doesn't teach us that our world is in trouble, I don't know what does. But you know, those people are doing a really good job of that, and I weigh in on those things on Facebook. But one thing I've become aware of is that those people seem to not be aware of shamanism, or they don't talk about it. And that's where I can come in as a writer and add that to the conversation. In other words, yes, we're starting to realize that we're living in a time of late stage predatory capitalism, and environmental destruction is baked into that system. So we need to consciousness shift. People need to start having robust conversations as they are about what a new economic system will look like. And that new system can include a certain amount of free markets and stuff. We're not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. But we all know, I think, that the current economic and political system is not serving the majority of mankind. And we've all read that statistic that you could put the people who own 50% of the world's wealth in a school bus. Now, I don't care what your political philosophy is, there's just something wrong with that few people control that much wealth and power, and that they're the ones deciding how it's going to be for billions of people. That's definitely a problem. The other thing that intersects with for me, and this is where I realized my 25-year environmental journalism career was perfect background, is that we all know that with climate change and other things, and ocean acidification, which often gets neglected, we're crossing a tipping point. And an interesting statistic that I read a while ago was I was born in 1960, and curiously, this study started in 1960, and it said that 50% of all life that was on this planet when I was born 56 years ago is gone. That doesn't mean half the species are gone, but if these scientists and biologists figured out a way of just measuring the totality of life. All the termites.
Now, does that include humans?
Yeah, humans. But humans are a small minority on this planet. I mean, if you just were to weigh all the termites, you know, there'd be way more termites than there are people. But so they somehow did this, and they found that 50% of all the life that existed on the Earth in 1960 is gone. So we are already halfway through a mass extinction event. And we have only begun to feel the effects of climate change. So really, the Earth will survive, but the thin layer of life on the Earth is in great peril. And really, for what? So that somebody can drive to the mall in the air-conditioned car? I mean, it's ridiculous why we're letting this happen. So anyway, so there are people... I feel very missionized to continue writing about and looking into environmental solutions, but not just from an economic model level or a environmental technology level, because I did that for 25 years. The thing that's new for me now is to make people aware that there is actually a Gaian mind, that there is actually, the Earth is actually a living conscious system, and that these shamanic plants, which are illegal where we're sitting right now, at least some of them, but they're coming back in a big way, and they can be used to access that consciousness that then gives guidance. And that was what the indigenous people around the world have done for hundreds of thousands of years, and it was our colonial dominator culture that suppressed that. You know, a lot of people don't realize that the story of St. Patrick driving the snakes out of Ireland is the story of Christianity driving the shamans or the medicine people out of Ireland. So I read somewhere that they're now saying that this killing of the female shamans, or later on they were called witches, but throughout the Middle Ages, it's estimated that upwards of 9 million female medicine holders were killed from the birth of Christianity to the modern era. I mean, that's just, think of the amount of indigenous knowledge, knowledge of plants, knowledge of spirituality, knowledge of healing that was exterminated as part of that. So now we have to, in order to connect with this, we have to go to places like the Upper Amazon that the conquistadors never got to. They murdered all the priests in the highlands, but they could never get every last tribe in the Amazon because of the difficulty of the environment. And those people, there's very few of them, but they hold the keys to the kingdom, and in a few other cultures. Now, the caveat I would say is, in North America and Europe, we don't have to mimic their specific modality of shamanism and spirituality and healing. What I'm interested in now is, now that I've had those insights and I've been to those other realms, it's a matter of bringing it to North America, finding out what are the North American plants that we can work with to create new traditions, and also speaking to our indigenous First Nations cousins, because they are also keepers of a lot of ancient wisdom. And, you know, we see that, well, it's iconic right now in the Dakotas with the proposed pipeline that the First Nations people have been opposing and putting their bodies on the line for. That's pretty emblematic of the struggle we're heading into. It is a planetary scale, and this might be a good note to wrap up on. It is a planetary scale battle between the people who understand sustainability and the consciousness shift agents around the world, some of whom will use plant medicines and some of whom won't, against a kind of archonic, militaristic, hierarchical, predatory capitalist system that is killing the planet and diverting trillions of dollars away from feeding the Earth's hungry and solving environmental problems. I mean, think of the trillions of dollars that have gone into these bogus wars in the Middle East, fighting terrorists that we now find were largely created by the CIA and the Saudis, and it all has to do with pipelines. It has nothing to do with a civil war in Syria or Libya. That was all just BS cover. I read an article by Robert Kennedy Jr. the other day, where he was interviewed, and he pointed out that the U.S. oil and gas industry receives $1 trillion a year in subsidies. Now, that's $1 trillion to subsidize not only an industry that's creating climate change, but we also know, even if you don't believe in climate change, we know those fossil fuels are going to run out in 50 or 60 years. And long before they actually run out, because of peak oil and economics, the price will shoot up 20 years ahead of time, 30 years ahead of time, to where they're not economically. So why are we spending $1 trillion subsidizing an industry that's on its way out? If that subsidy was not given to oil and gas, it would not be competitive with solar and wind and renewables. And if, as I would advocate, if we directed all that, or at least some of that money that's going to wars and to the oil and gas industry, to clean technologies and green technologies, we could actually turn this around fairly quickly, actually. And that's what I'm now working to do. So on the one hand, I've got this spiritual awakening and crazy dreams and visions of snakes made up of light, which you wouldn't think has anything to do with the real world. And on the other hand, all of that has given me insight and has missionized me to spur people on a very practical level to reorganize our economy and to implement new strategies and technologies to get us on a sustainable footing. And I guess the last thing I'll say is we're out of time. This is not something we can leave to our children and grandchildren. I have read and I agree that what we do in the next 10 years will be more important than what we do in the next 10,000 years. The next 10 years, we're either going to turn the juggernaut around and create sustainability, or it will be too late and we will go through the Anthropocene. And as Terence McKenna beautifully put it, the human experiment will be a layer in the geological record somewhere between the dinosaurs and the megafauna and whatever else comes afterwards. And I would like to personally not only see human beings go on for a long time and go to the next level and conquer the stars or whatever we're going to do, but I don't want to see us dragging down all those other animals and elephants and tigers and ecosystems and whales. They didn't deserve this. They don't deserve for us to extinct them, which we are doing. So,
well, yeah, I wouldn't even want to. I mean, that's part of this. My motivation is not necessarily to see humans go on forever, but just to avoid watching nature slowly fall apart and just disappear. I just think it's incredibly sad to see, you know, like I remember being in public school back in the day and you know, the teachers would show us the dodo bird or other extinct creatures, and I used to think it was so sad, but we're losing creatures every single day.
Yeah, 2015 was the first year that a third of the Great Barrier Reef bleached. Now a coral can come back from a bleaching event, but if that keeps happening, that will eventually kill that reef and others like it. I know it's just morally and ethically, it fills me with such a sense of outrage. I think of that Bruce Coburn song, you know, if I had a rocket launcher, I just become incensed about it. But, you know, one of the things I've learned in the shamanic teachings and from the plants is literally that nature will go on and it will keep being creative and keep inventing. But what nature loves is novelty. And so if you go back to the beginning of the universe, the beginning of life on this planet, it was very simple, one cell, and it's become increasingly complicated. It's like an algorithm written in DNA that's gone on this immense journey and has become us and has become plants and all these things. So we're living in this very rich, complex web of life and all this wonderful novelty. This morning I saw a video of a chameleon being born that I posted on Facebook, and it was just so amazing watching this creature come out of its shell and just see the world for the first time. And we just don't have the right, it would be so tragic to destroy that novelty just so that, you know, the number of people who could fit in a school bus can make even more money out of whatever it is they're doing.
What would they need with all that money and power? I mean, the power is to keep themselves in power.
Yeah.
But the money, I mean, trillions and trillions of dollars, like, who needs that kind of cash, and what could you even do with it?
Yeah, it's a very sick game. And one of the things I don't understand is why more of those people aren't turning around and using their money to change this. But even if we look at people like Bill Gates and we say, okay, you know, if he's William Buffett and they're giving their money to charity, it still shouldn't be in the hands of that few people to decide what the priorities should be. And if you look at the trajectory we're on, not enough is being done with the money to reflect what ordinary people want, which is they want sustainability. But again, you know, we can go to websites like Glenn Greenwald's The Intercept or Chris Hedges' truth dig, and we can learn about the economics, and people smarter than you and I are looking at that. But what has not penetrated the mainstream culture yet, although it's going to, is this ancient indigenous spiritual knowledge. And when not everyone has to do it, but when you drink ayahuasca and you discover that there's another dimension made up of pure consciousness, where the collective unconscious of all the human beings that ever lived is archived, and you can access that sacred knowledge. And I know for anyone who hasn't drank this medicine, I'm going to sound like a lunatic, but when you realize that that exists, that is a big component of solving this problem. And so that's why I promote those medicines used responsibly. And there's an interesting interview with the chair of the MAPS psychedelic organization in Canada, and he said that he feels that the use of psychedelics in a therapeutic context is going to become legal not too far from now. And I hope he's right, because you know, cannabis is legalization is kicking the door open on that. But you know, if I have one thing to say to people listening to this, is we need to move past the point where we're excited that people can smoke marijuana and get stoned. Like, that's great because it never should have been illegal. But I'm telling you, a plant like cannabis has tremendous potential way beyond that experience. It has the potential to heal even things like cancer, but it is also one of the great teacher plants. When I smoke cannabis, which I don't do very often, I don't enjoy it much, I don't get that, but when I eat it in a certain amount, I access this other realm, and I learn things. Now, who would have thought that? So, yeah, we're in a very interesting area, you and I, Dan.
Most certainly. So, we've concluded that change needs to happen, that the economic system, as it is now, is a driver for, it's profit. And profit oftentimes comes at the expense of nature, expense of the environment, and of human populations. So there's a lot of talk about change. People fear change. And I think that one of the preventive factors that really is kind of standing in the way of real change is that, well, one, we don't have a visionary leader to drive the change. We don't have, people are familiar with the system as is, and there's a whole lot of scattered kind of opinions and people coming from different backgrounds, different mm-hmm. spiritual beliefs, different religious beliefs that are putting forth ideas, but it's still very broken in terms of like a unified message. I think the last time humanity was assembled in such a degree was when religion really had a stronghold, and when kind of the Christian power structures were able to kind of assemble people and motivate people to act based on one particular belief system. You know, to go into a new country and start murdering anyone who has no mm-hmm. or has different beliefs.
Which we still do, but now it's over oil. But your point is well taken.
Yeah. So, another issue is that our Earth, which is, as you said, one organism, it is one system made up of multitude of smaller systems, but ultimately we do not manage it like it is one system. We manage it from, you know, the smaller microsystem complex, and I think that's a major issue as well. And I think the smarter we get, you know, we just really have to treat this like we need to get a thermostat on this planet. We need to start taking global readings and managing it like the single system it is. And that in itself is a consciousness shift. And it also brings up the question of, you know, how do you manage a planet? You know, it's like it almost, in my mind, would make sense to have some type of a planetary management council or some type of an authority, but you don't want to get into a one world government kind of thing. And I'm just wondering what the next kind of paradigm could look like in actually managing the planet from a singular unified perspective.
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that, although I tend to lean toward being a bit more, if somebody said, Guy, what is your politics? At this point, I would say I'm an anarchist socialist, and I don't even really know what that means. Let me give you an example. On a very practical level, I'm on the board of this Amazon Rainforest Conservancy, or ARC, which our friend Jana Bell manages, and I know you contribute to it with donations. And she is raising funds in North America, and she's buying Amazon land in the Madre de Dios region and keeping it out of the hands of wildcat loggers and illegal gold miners. So there's something on, it's a very specific project. It doesn't need a global strategy to do. So we need a lot more of those individual inspired projects. I think my response to the need for global coordination is that will happen when something very, very fundamental occurs, and that is when human beings truly begin to regard nature as sacred again. That is the missing piece. That is what is missing from the technocratic discussions about whether we should build this kind of solar panel or that kind of geothermal thing. I don't think we're ever going to get to the point we need to on a planetary scale until human beings collectively go back to viewing nature as sacred. And that's, you know, there's a lot of people who are involved in conservation who, if you ask them, they go, oh yeah, nature's sacred, but they don't really view it as sacred. I know that in my experiences with the shamanic experience, I now regard nature really as sacred. I'm the kind of person that if I see a spider, it sounds cliche, but if I see a spider, I don't kill it. I put it in a bottle and I put it outside because that's a life. That's one of the reasons I've gone vegan, but that's a whole other discussion. But what the indigenous people have been trying to tell us for hundreds of years, and the shamanic experiences teach us over and over and over again, is that nature actually is sacred, it is spiritual, we are all one, we are all local expressions of a cosmic intelligence, and it's a very loving cosmic intelligence, believe it or not. And so that's the missing piece that I'm trying to inject into the conversation. It's very difficult because people immediately go, oh, you're talking about drugs, or oh, I wouldn't want to drink drugs. But we don't need to get to the point where everybody does it. If you subscribe to the 100th monkey syndrome, if just 1 in 1,000 people get there, or one, whatever the number is, it doesn't have to be everybody. There's a critical tipping point that you reach when a certain number of people have their consciousness raised. It suddenly flips everybody. It's like for years nobody could break the 4-minute mile, and then suddenly somebody broke it. And then it became routine that people all over the world were breaking it. And that sort of, Rupert Sheldrake with his morphogenic fields talks about that a lot. I think if we get to a certain number of people who awaken, access what I'm talking about with this other dimension, whatever it is, it will be enough to change the world. And that's what makes me optimistic. We don't have to get every single person. We might not even have to get 1 in 100. But there's a certain number, and that's why I write. And that's what I get up in the morning to do, as I know you do in a different way, and with this podcast.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's ultimately how we got to move forward. The plants are allies in that, helping connect people to nature and helping expand the consciousness. I think that's a good spot to finish up. But if you guys take anything away from this conversation, there's lots to take away. But as Guy said it, there's no more passing the buck. There's no more leaving it to our children's generations to figure this out. It's on us. I remember when I was young and my parents and my teachers were telling us that it was our generation who was going to change the world. You know what? But now I see people my age with kids saying, oh, it's their generation that's going to change the world. I call bullshit on that. I say, you know, we've got to take ownership of the outcome here and get to it. You know, there's no more time to screw around. There's no more time to keep our heads in the sand and just let the school bus full of people that run this world drive all the rest of us into extinction. So, we request that you join the movement and share up this podcast and have a look at Guy's writings on the Pulse Tours website. He's got lots of really great articles on there. You will see more. You will hear more from Guy Crittenden. Hopefully at some point we can tee up a dual podcast with Guy and Jana Bell, the founder of Amazon Rainforest Conservancy. We'll try to get on that. But for now, that's it. Thank you very much, Guy.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks for all you do and keep doing it.
I'll fight to save another day.